Okay, so at the end of 7 weeks of story, I promised you that we wouldn't do any review. But I'd like you to look at it like this. So if we spent 7 weeks looking at how to write or how to craft a good story for your life, the only thing that's missing is actually getting out there and doing it. So this leadership series, while it is not directly tied, nor was it ever intended to be tied in any way to the story series, there's a lot of useful material that you're going to be able to glean from this that will help you to start to live out some of the commitments that you've made perhaps during the story series. All right, so before we get started, this is the part where you can take maybe the backside of your second page. There's probably some blank real estate there. And what we're going to be doing, I want to ask a series of questions. It's going to be the first part of your homework for the week. This is going to be very, very practical. So here's what I'm going to ask for this week. It's going to start with this. During the course of the next 4 weeks, here's what I'm going to ask. I'm not really so much interested in a lot of feedback, or you tell me this, or you say this. As a matter of fact, right now it would be more distracting to talk than not to talk, and I would like us to ask questions. Help us to interact with each other through questions. Here's the first thing. In my workplace, and I'm just going to read this, in my workplace, within my work team or division, keep your mind focused solely on work right now, or inside my business, what is good, and I know this? Give yourself an answer to that. The questions are all on the front side of the front page. I don't want you to look there now. They're there for you to look at later when you don't write this down. What's good in your workplace that you know? In other words, and here's the thing that we're looking at, what's worth preserving there? What's good at your place of work, in among your coworkers, your team, the culture of the organization, whatever it is, what is good there that's worth keeping? All right, the next question. What in your business, where you work, whatever that is, define that as you will, what needs some improvement? And you know it. There's not a debate. And this phrase, and I know this, you need to apply this to every one of these things. You need to be convinced that this is true. What needs to be improved? And you know it for a fact. Don't worry for right now whether you would know how to improve it. Just don't even concern yourself with that. There is something that needs to be improved there, and you know exactly what it is. It may be. It may be that right now you're the only one who knows that it needs to be improved, but it could be that the entire organization knows it needs to be improved, and it's just not being addressed. Okay, the next question. What needs to be removed? What's there that you know is in the way? It's lived too long a life. It's half past time and then some for it to go.
Yeah, it's about you're talking about stuff in the workplace that needs to be removed, improved.
Right.
This is with our surrounding environment or things that we do.
Interpret that as you will. In other words, are you saying, ask the question again, so I think.
Like how to improve our work environment?
Yeah.
Or how we act and react to
situations. Okay, maybe you are the thing that's broken in your workplace. Yeah. I'm going to hope that you don't assume that you're the thing that needs to be removed from your workplace, although that could be true. But maybe you are the thing that needs to be improved, and you know this. Remember that phrase, and you know this.
That's more real morale crusher.
Okay, that's personal testimony. We haven't gotten to that part of the session yet. All right, in my workplace, within my work team, etc., 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 what is an opportunity that exists for which there is now no good solution? In other words, what needs to be created from scratch? Don't worry if you know how to create it, what needs to be created. You just know that there is something that is noticeably missing and it should be improved. All right, now once you've gotten a feel for this, out of all of this stuff, here's the final question. What burden do you feel to be involved? Of all the stuff that you wrote down, what is the thing that you believe that you could exert influence over? Now, that's going to change, but right now, just record your thoughts. What could I potentially do about this? Which ones would I or should I address versus which ones don't I even feel any obligation to address? Do you feel a personal responsibility for any of what you've just written down?
So you said homework.
Yeah, because you can't possibly answer this question in any level of depth in 2 minutes. I'm just walking.
I need a lot of paper for that.
Well, that's why you're going to go home and get a legal pad out. Which is it you need? And we haven't even gotten into the, wait, this is just the primer.
What's number five again?
Okay, so number five is, what is your level of personal responsibility for any of this? What do you feel that you should own of all of this? So I didn't ask you to assign responsibility yet. All I've said is, what do you notice? What do you notice that's good and you believe it should be kept? What do you notice that needs some improvement? What do you notice that needs to be removed or extracted or dismantled? And then finally, what do you notice that there is no present good solution for? Something needs to be created. Now, once you've answered all of them, what level of personal responsibility do you feel for what, if any, of that?
So basically, what am I willing to take responsibility for?
Right, and that may change. Just write down your initial reflections. Because, wait, there's more. Okay, now because some of you right at this moment may not feel passionate about your work, we've got to take this in different directions. I want you to apply every one of these questions to your family and your marriage. What's good and needs to be kept? What's there but needs to be improved? What do you know that needs to be removed? What exists for which there is no good current solution? Could be with your children. It could be your marriage. Now we're going to apply this to your neighborhood, your surroundings. You're out of work, but not in your house life. Your community, your church. So by the time you are done, every area of life that you touch, that your fingerprints are on, every single area of your life, you should have asked this question, all four of those questions, and then number five, determine whether you have any personal responsibility or desire to address any of it.
Now that can look like, I don't take responsibility for any of these as well.
That you would not want to take any responsibility? Yeah, you could, if you chose to say that, yes, you could. I think that would be difficult. It would be difficult for me to look at that and not sense some level of responsibility, but maybe for some that's not the case. So one last time, what's worth keeping? What needs to be improved? What needs to be removed? What needs to be created that now does not exist in any form? All right, so you're going to come back and you're going to spend some time looking at these. Incidentally, this is not one of these series that you're going to come to and you're going to be amused and entertained. We're all going to have a few laughs and go home. You're either going to do something with this or this is really a waste of your time, honestly. Which means, because we don't have enough time to cover this, you are going to have to take this home and actually think about it. Some of you will have plenty of time. I know you have a very long commute. You have a lot of open time where you could think about things. I wouldn't recommend that you write long detailed notes while you're driving, but in shorthand somehow you could capture your thoughts. Every good phone has a way to just speak into the phone and capture ideas. So. Oh, do you still have one of those flip phones?
He's a dinosaur. No, you're a dinosaur.
All right. This may be the first thing in your life that needs to be improved. Okay, we might just want to start there. Okay, finally, before we get off of this. All right, let's get serious again. What's at stake? This is what you have to answer yet before you start to move into this, especially the personal responsibility question. What is at stake if everything remains exactly the way it is? Or what's at stake, for instance, in those things that you think are good the way they are, what's at stake if they're lost? You don't have to answer that right now, but I want... here's the way this works. Some of you are asking questions because you didn't immediately latch on to something. That's perfectly okay. There's at least one person in the room who already knows, oh my word, I know that one thing that needs to be removed. I know exactly what it is, and I can tell you what my level of responsibility for it is that I've been avoiding for 5 years already. Some of you don't sense that immediately. It's going to take more time. So the reason we're going through the questions now is to help you to understand them. If you have any questions about the questions, now's the time to ask. But if not, yes, you're going to spend some time. Dan, you'll need maybe more than one legal pad now that we introduced family and community and all that.
Well, yeah, you could apply these questions to a lot of things.
You can?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's at stake? To whom will it matter? Final thing, what do I honestly believe will happen if I remain passive? The operative word there is honestly, okay? Politicians deal in the dramatic. And because of that, they paint pictures of what could be that's unrealistic or what might happen if we don't do this that's equally unrealistic. Right? So don't flatter yourself by saying that the entire little marble that we spin around on is going to sink into the abyss if you single-handedly do not solve the world's problems. That's drama. That's not realistic. What do you believe will happen if the problem is not addressed and if you do not shoulder some level of responsibility? Okay, so bottom of the first page, you can now turn your page over and read along with me. This won't be a typical treatment of leadership, or at least not typical in theoretical, as in theoretical study of what leading looks like. As we look around in both this country and others, what we see are conflicts, divisions, wars, wealth which is not well dispersed, and a certain level of dissatisfaction with social and moral positions which have served us well for generations. Does any of that ring true for you? If you pick up a paper, watch the evening news, listen to your coworkers, does any of that sound familiar to you? Is there social unrest? Is there dissatisfaction? Are there wars in various places over various things and ideologies? If all this is true, how did it get that way? There have been many other times like these, but not quite the same. Since today, there is ready access to information as has never been before, and an equally ready access to platforms for personal expression. That means that it's not as if wars didn't ever take place. It's not as if social injustice or inequity was not present throughout all of human history. It's just that we know it now in a way that we didn't know it before. The man of 1,000 years ago lived in his little hamlet. There was a mountain on either side of him, and once every 5 years, perhaps he ventured to the other side of the mountain, to the next hamlet, and that's the extent of what most people's knowledge was. Today, we can know what's happening across the globe within a half an hour, maybe within minutes. But that's not the end of it. Each of us has at our fingertips the means to express our opinions about whatever we see. And that, too, is available to millions and millions of other people around the world. So it's very different today than it's ever been before, and it's only going to get more complex. Do not believe for a moment that it's going to get less complex. What you experience today is going to be amplified by a factor of 10 within 20 years or 30 years. Your children are going to live in a thoroughly different world than the world that you think is already changing so fast you can't imagine what it will be like in 5 years, and they're growing up accustomed to it. Do you understand? So that what you think is normal and your head is spinning and saying, how can it get any more out of control? They accept this level of lack of control. For them, that's normal. All right. It may not be that the current or past leaders and their practices of the craft have failed so much as it is that more people and more challenges and higher levels of expectation than ever before exist. In other words, the man who lives in his little hamlet and has a subsistence life, he's found out that there's people on the other side of the world that live better than he does. And he's now discontent. He wasn't discontent before, He might have been frustrated. He might have been exhausted. His life might have been difficult. But because he assumed that everybody else lived exactly the same as he did, he was not discontent. But now he knows that he has reason to be discontent. Now what happens when you put 8 billion people together in a globe and they're all discontented? What happens when you put 4 people in your living room and they're all discontented? Okay, I just want you to feel this. What happens when 4 people, 4 family members all sit around in one room and they're discontented? Do you feel the dilemma? Things are not naturally going to get better. And so my premise is this: what's needed is not more of a few great leaders. It's more a sense of personal responsibility and ownership that more of us become leaders.
If they're not going to get better, what's going to happen?
What do you mean? If things are not going to get better?
No, they're not going to get better.
Well, we have watched at times in human history things devolve rather than evolve. We have watched an absence of progress. We've watched regress. Right? And we still see it in small nation states in Africa where things just devolve into chaos. There was a time when there was the Sudan, right? I believe it is. And now there's the North and there's the South Sudan. And the South Sudan, as it were, seceded from the North Sudan because they figured if they were on their own, things would be better. Well, guess what? Now the South Sudan is at civil war with itself. So it's not as if we could just remove ourselves and our problems will go away because we're no longer part of the bigger picture. The truth is we can't get along with ourselves. Put 2 people in a room and there can be conflict. Do you doubt this? Put yourself in a room and sometimes there can be conflict. Is that not true? All right. So we've covered this, but I want to repeat it one more time, and here's why. Because as you move through life, if you aspire to any kind of leadership, and we'll get into what I believe leadership is. Well, let's just talk about what leadership is now. It is the mission that you choose to own, if you choose to own it, as you walk through life, to ask yourself this question about whatever you see. What about that deserves to be preserved? What needs to be preserved there? What's good? Let me give you an example from current events. So if you follow the news at all, you know that President Obama is on his last farewell hurrah tour around Europe and various parts of the globe. He made a speech the other day in which he was talking to people in Europe and he said, we should never assume that what we have today will always be that way, and it is the responsibility of people to start to notice what they have heretofore taken for granted. He said this about democracy. Don't ever assume that just because democracy is the normal rule of things in the developed parts of the world that it will always be that way. Now, we can apply that to anything. Whether you're a fan of the president or not, that's a good, solid truth to embrace. Don't take for granted the good things that are good that you have that you may be taking for granted because it's not an inevitable outcome that they will stay that way forever. Your good marriage. Well, here's how we can sum this up. Absolutely nothing good stays that way by accident. Put that to the test in your own life. It doesn't matter whether it's the roof on your house or human relationships or a business structure or even business finance. Nothing good stays that way without intentional and diligent management. What do you dearly love that you believe is so important that you need to look at not just consuming it or using it or living within it, but you need to start to take a personal ownership of it because you realize there was a time when this did not exist and then it came into existence, but it is equally possible that it could go out of existence if I don't take some responsibility for it. Now, apply that to whatever you want to in life. I'm not here to tell you what your sphere or area of leadership is, but I want you to understand that this goes right down to the core of your family. If there are 2 people in your household, it matters. If you are in a workforce of 3, it matters. If you live next door to somebody, it matters. So here's the way we're going to, and we can read this together. It's on the back of your first page. Leadership is not necessary in any area of life where one of these four objectives is not needed. Okay, that was perhaps a confusing way of stating it, so let me say it a different way. There is no leadership necessary. You are completely off the hook. There is no need for anybody to do anything about any area of life where you believe that there is nothing good that could be lost, nothing good that needs to be improved, nothing that you notice that ever needs to be removed, or nothing that needs a better way of doing it in a new system for doing it. No leadership is necessary if all four of those are guaranteed to stay the way they are. Do you understand what I just said? Now, here's the question. What area of life can you point to and say that leadership isn't necessary based on that criteria? Didn't it? Because there was something good that could be lost, and we read the rest of the story about that. There was something good that could be lost.
Yeah, right. Close to, that was ever, as close as we were ever going to be to not needing to do something.
But even in that, and I want you to understand, this is not all wrong, even in that, when God brings the animals to Adam, what does Adam do? He says, these animals need a name. That's something that needs to be improved. It's good, but it needs to be improved. We don't know but what Adam and Eve might have had chances to build systems for managing the garden had they remained in a pristine environment long enough. So the point is, there is no area of your life or mine that does not require leadership. Here's the question, do you see yourself as a leader? Because most people don't. All right, let's move on to the next thing. Things don't stay fixed. Just meditate on that. Your car doesn't stay fixed. Your house doesn't stay fixed. Your relationships don't stay fixed. And that by itself explains a lot about why people come into positions of power, into ministry. People begin ministries. People do good work. Why doesn't the world get better if people are always doing good work? Because things are in a constant state of needing. We live in a temporal world where nothing stays the same for very long. We like this idea of solving problems. I fix it and it's done. In other words, I tell my wife, this is the way I expect you to be, and it's done. How's that work? This relationship is going to be this way, and that's it. We've had this discussion. We had this discussion for 3 hours one evening. This discussion is done, and henceforth, everything will run this way. All right, now, we know that doesn't happen. And even if there was, let's say, a miniature signing of the Paris Treaty, and even if there was a meeting of the minds that occurred for one moment in your living room one Friday evening, that treaty is likely to be broken by Sunday morning. It'll be put to the test, as a matter of fact, on the ride to church on Sunday morning. Okay, facts. Let's just quickly read through the facts. Things don't stay fixed for very long. Some will oppose to your fixes and seek to undo them. So remember, we said that first off, one of the reasons why great change initiatives don't keep things changed is because that things tend to degrade. The second thing is, not everybody agrees on what needs to be changed or how it should be changed. That means that while you're tinkering on the front side of the machine, there's somebody around the back side of the machine that's twisting the screws the other way because they're trying to undo the very thing that you're trying to put into place. Or the thing that you're trying to preserve, they want to change because we don't agree, all of us, about what's good and needs to be kept, what needs to be improved or how to improve it, what needs to be removed. If you doubt this, even for a moment, just put this to the test in our current political climate. Is this not true? For everything that one side attempts, the other side wants to undo it. Do you see the complexity? Do you see the challenge? This is why great leadership matters. But here's the other thing. See, it's not just that they're trying to ruin our good fixes. In their mind, we're trying to ruin their good fixes. What does that make us?
Racist.
Well, yes, but that's the new term for it. What else does that make us? It makes us enemies of each other. Because if you think something is good and want to keep it, but I think that very thing that you call good is not good and is getting in the way of progress, then in order for me to achieve the progress that I need to achieve, I need to get you out of the way because you're going to fight hard to keep what you believe is good. You see, now you can start to appreciate the battle of good and evil as it plays itself out in the daily lives of people. You want something to stay the way it is. Somebody else desperately wants something to change because they believe that that thing, the way you want it, is just completely wrong. Okay, let's read this final thing together. In this specific sense, leadership is a battle of ideas and the struggle to see which will thrive and which will wither. Right, now, we can embrace that and we can all philosophically get our heads around that. That leadership, at its essence, becomes a conflict of ideas or a war of ideas. But here's the thing. We talked about this a while back when it came to the subject of apologetics, but we're going to apply this now to leadership. A bad idea in the hands of a great leader can thrive. And a really good idea in the hands of a bad leader can wither and die. So it's not just that the idea stands on its own strength. It's not just that good stands on its own merits. It doesn't. Good in the hands of bad leadership perishes. And in the same way, evil in the hands of great leadership thrives and succeeds.
And a perfect example, the Marine Corps.
You're going to have to bring us a little more of that for...
You just described it. That's been my entire experience with the Marine Corps. There's been a few good leaders that can execute and have other people helping them execute a good plan. But I've also seen so many other bad leaders with good plans destroy it, and it looks like an abortion. You know, it's also the other way around. A terrible plan trying to be executed by a great leader.
Now, one final thing that we got to throw into the mix. Remember at the tail end of all the questions it asked? As why does it matter? What's at stake? Who will be benefited or who will be harmed by whatever this is? Here's the thing. Bad ideas, even if they're ultimately proven to be bad, inflict temporary or even long-range consequences on a whole host of people. So even if, and I have relied on this at times in my own thinking, that good will be vindicated in the end, right? Solid thinking will be proved right because wicked thinking or bad thinking or just sloppy thinking will ultimately be revealed for what it is. And I still believe that they ultimately will be revealed for what it is, but here's the problem. How many people will be damaged before it's revealed? See, in this country, we're looking at that socially because over the last 100 years, we have embarked on major social transformations, led by a few. They were smart people, they were skilled people, but their ideas, perhaps, according to some of us, were misguided. But because we didn't take seriously the threat to what was good and needed to be preserved, we allowed them to institute social change. All right, so now, 40 plus years later, we look at the fact that four out of every 10 children are born to a single mom. Just that fact alone is staggering. When you understand, this is not just a judgment about whether you should be single or married. This is a judgment about what happens to the kids that are born into single-parent households. What is the probability of their succeeding in life? It's lower than the probability of those born into functioning two-parent households. Why? Because a single parent cannot generate the income, be the parent, be all this at the same time. What was the social experiment that was begun? That you could detach committed monogamous relationship from sex. Right now, it sounds appealing. Look, this is a room full of guys, okay? So we can just put it right out there. The concept of detaching sex from commitment for the rest of your life to one woman, boy, that has its momentary appeals, doesn't it? And if you're not laughing right now, you don't understand, okay?
The damage that can...
Well, there you go. Or maybe you're actually the byproduct of what happens when that's true. All right, we're going to bypass what's left on the bottom of the first page. So the final thought that I want us to leave with is a bad idea will have consequences even if it's later demonstrated to be bad. Well, before I leave that, one final thought. Remember what I said? The experiment, social experiment, 40 years in the making. Where were you 40 years ago?
Not thought of.
It's a long time. In other words, sometimes it takes generations to discover that a bad idea is a bad idea. Do you understand? Sometimes there will be generations that will feel the pain of bad leadership before somebody wakes up and says, this isn't going so well, maybe we need to try something different. The scriptures, incidentally, are filled with that. The scriptures are filled with multi-generational consequence that befalls people because of one person's bad leadership or a group of people's bad leadership. And downstream, 3 and 4 and 5 generations, they're still paying the price for that. Well, as a matter of fact, the story of the Bible is one big story of when you make the wrong choice because leadership isn't in place, other people pay the price. Isn't that the story of the Garden of Eden? Right? The story of the Garden of Eden, among the thousands of other stories that we can look at of it, is Adam probably should have said something. Hey, I think that's a bad idea. Maybe we should talk this through before you eat the fruit. Instead of, so how tasty was that fruit?
I'm not eating that. That's how that should have went. I'm not eating that.
And we assume that that conversation never took place.
So Adam was a poor leader.
At that moment, we have to conclude that he was.
And it's okay to say that, yes.
Yeah, it is.
It's okay to say that, yes.
I was taking it one step
further.
It's a failure of nerve.
I was having a conversation with somebody a little while ago, like the time frame. You know, Adam had time to name every animal that, I mean, I'm assuming that we have today. You know, he's also, I mean, the time frame between the starting of the garden, you know, the planet and all that, to get out, that had to have been centuries. You know, I mean, that there was no sense of time because they were in God's presence. You know, so how long did it take this serpent to convince Eve to, hey, you know, you need this?
And so in your thinking, it might have been a gradual wearing down rather than a one-time encounter. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We don't know that, but the reality is something was missing. And we're all paying the price for it generations later. All right. So let's not be too hard on Adam. All right? Have you ever failed to speak up? Have you ever failed to do the right thing? Have you ever taken the easy path? Of course. Right? So let's not be too... No, you haven't.
I'm saying plenty of times.
Oh, okay.
Your kid was supposed to go to bed at 8 o'clock. They cried like mad, so you let them stay up. What happened the next night?
All right. So we are now on to, I told you we're going to forget what's left. We're going to come back to that. I realized this morning that the notes that I worked up last night, I left a few things in that I shouldn't have. So let's come over to the top of the second page. There are many types of leadership. I'm going to introduce an additional level of complexity now. Your homework assignment for the week is just not done. It hasn't even but gotten barely started. You have all week. You've got until next week. It's all good. And we're going to be in this for 4 weeks. So if you don't get it all done on week one, there's a grace period. You can do it on week two. All right. The first type of leadership is thought leadership. In other words, people who communicate ideas and they have innovative ideas and actually share them with others. Politicians are very often great thought leaders. That's not a bad thing. Academics are very often great thought leaders. University professors, great thought leaders. Obviously, people that work in what we refer to as think tanks or policy organizations, they're all great thought leaders. What's a thought leader? Just so we're clear, what is that?
Somebody comes up with ideas and improves them.
Yeah.
Even if they can't do it themselves.
That is an operative word there, even if they can't do it themselves. As a matter of fact, they may not even be responsible for doing it themselves. They sense the burden to work through and generate new ideas, to sift through the ideas that they've created and say, this one ultimately couldn't work, or this one needs to be combined with this other one. They invest their lives in what we'd call the virtual world, almost. In other words, in things that are abstract. Remember the questions that I asked at the beginning. What role does new thinking play in preserving what's good, improving what isn't, or improving things that are good, removing what's bad, or creating something altogether new? What role does thought leadership play? Because here's what you have to understand. It's not enough to know that something needs to be fixed. You need to understand what type of leadership is necessary in order to get the process started or keep what's good kept. All right, organizational leaders. So organizational leaders are simply people who know how to bring people together, unite them around something, and keep a system of people working well. To illustrate this, of the questions that I asked you, is there anything, any of the answers that you thought of in the moment or probably will think of that require more than you to be involved? Is the solution to something that you want solved, does that mandate that several people be involved in it? If it does, then a degree of organizational leadership is necessary. Okay, and the next one, action-oriented leadership, we get that. These are people who just seem to know how to get stuff done. They don't necessarily come up with the ideas, but you give that person the idea, and you're astounded at how quickly it's done. For the thought leader, the thing that he thought was going to take 30 years, he places it in the right hands. Remember the competent leader? The competent leader knows how to get things done, and an action-oriented person will sift through all the stuff, get rid of the crap that's going to stand in the way, and figure out the shortest, best way to get from here to there. Is that what's missing? Here, put it to the test like this. Is there something in your organization where you've been talking about change for 20 years, and yet no change is accomplished? Is there something in a relationship where you've been talking about change for 5 years, and yet no change has been accomplished? You know all about the theories of change. You know all about the good ideas and the benefits of change. You've explored all of them. Somebody just needs to make a couple of steps forward. So the action-oriented leader, as a final summation of that, he's not willing to say, well, you go first and then I'll follow. He says, I'll go first and maybe you'll follow. But I'll go first even if you don't follow. All right. Moral leadership. We're going to talk more about this next week, because every week we're going to focus on a different text of Scripture, ultimately, and we're going to look at a couple of different things. So moral leadership, I can be detached from the people who I will influence and lead through my moral leadership. Moral leadership is simply doing the right thing and showing people how to do the right thing and that the right thing can be done. So we'll think about this in the political realm. Gandhi was a fantastic moral leader. His moral leadership influenced Martin Luther King heavily. Did Martin Luther King's life influence anybody in this country? Tremendously. And so Gandhi, by virtue of being a moral leader, demonstrated qualities of how to initiate change peacefully that Martin Luther King adopted. And we can only imagine what the civil rights movement would have looked like if King had gone the more violent route, the way some had preferred. As a matter of fact, the way most had preferred, in spite of King's adamant insistence, no, we'll turn the other cheek. We'll go rent cheeks if we need to, because we will keep turning the other cheek. All right, the final kind of leadership that we're going to look at is system-building leadership. It's prototypical leadership. We need a small version of what will later on be done in a big scale. Jesus with his apostles, the first century church, all of that is prototypical leadership. Does the church today look different than it did in the first century? Absolutely. But is it built on the prototype model of the first century? Unquestionably. And so we need people that can develop systems on a small scale and experiment and tweak with the systems to get it right. Because once it's right, it can be scaled up. So what would that look like in your home? Well, systems building leadership or prototypical leadership would look like a relationship between a husband and wife where they started to work through their problems. And as the kids watched the husband and wife take on a new relationship with each other, the kids would say, maybe we can try some of that in our own life. But see, the parents don't have the, and here's where we start to pull them together, the parents don't have the moral credibility to ask something of their kids that they haven't first demonstrated. All right, now here's the final dilemma. Right, start to think this week about which one of these is significantly missing in the challenges that you face. One of these is never a substitute for another. Do you understand what I mean? You cannot do more of one. You cannot have more of one type of leadership to just make up for a shortfall of another kind of leadership. What happens if you have an action-oriented leader, the guy who's going to get stuff done, but there's no thought leadership?
You can execute a lot of bad ideas.
Oh, you can quickly too, can't you? Because if you have the action-oriented leader that's executing ideas, but the ideas suck, he's going to get to a lot of bad places very fast because he's the action guy. What happens if you have great thought leadership without moral example? Well, we see that in this country. We've got a lot of pioneering ideas, a lot of brave, bold ideas coming from a lot of sources, but they aren't grounded in any kind of agreeable morality. One type of leadership is not a substitute for another. Every one of these types of leadership is necessary for something to thrive, ultimately. Okay. Three questions here. What is the type of connection between a leader and those he is leading? So for you to be a leader, you need to ask this question, what is the connection between me and the thing or the people that I want to influence? Is it ideas? Is it action? Is it some sort of moral authority? Are you the tinkerer that's going to build a small prototype of something? Are you just the guy who gets things done? So as an illustration, and we'll pick the action-oriented leader because it's so easy to see this. Right? Have you ever watched this happen? You come into a new setting, and there's some work needs to be done. Maybe it's a volunteer thing. There's 10 people in the room, and there's a job that needs to be done. Have you ever noticed that sooner or later, generally within the first half hour, there's somebody that rises to the top. They're just the guy who organizes things, gets things going, and moves things ahead. It's not as if everybody steps up and all together. Somebody sort of naturally, organically, without being appointed, rises to the top, and they're the guy that gets things moving and going for other people. What is your relationship and the relationship of your leadership to the problem that needs to be solved? Who are you? If you had to pinpoint yourself of these five types of leaders, which type are you? Which type do you excel at? Are you a get-her-done kind of guy? Do you like to talk ideas? There's nothing wrong with talking ideas. Well, Lord knows, we know that there's a lot of bad ideas out there. Are you sort of like a moral authority? Meaning, not you're the judgment police, but you tend to be concerned about figuring out a just and moral way to do something, and you will cast aside something that you don't feel is just, even if it will get the job done. So just understand what your relationship is to those you lead. All right. So here's what we're all going to do. Here's the second part of your homework assignment. Was the first part clear? Was it long enough? Will it keep you busy for 5 minutes? Good. Let's turn over to Ezra. And I'm going to actually want y'all to turn there. If you have a Bible. Does anybody need a Bible? Yeah, if you've got an electronic one, it's probably best. I've got one phone I can share with somebody. See, this is the one week where it turns out you need your Bible at the Bible study. Go figure. I know that's not always true. That's okay. Give me just a moment, Ron.
I can listen well.
I might need to borrow this from time to time. Ezra 1. Okay, so here's the back story. As we go through this, what I want you to be looking for is types of leadership that you see, or its absence. I want you to be looking for the principles that we've talked about this morning. And you're going to go back this week and you're going to read this book. It's not all that long. It's actually fascinating. Once I give you a little bit of history for it, it's a really good read. So, the Northern Kingdom, after they split, after there is a civil war, the Northern Kingdom is wiped out by the Assyrians, so they don't exist. There's two tribes left. It's the Southern Kingdom. The Southern Kingdom is taken essentially into exile by the Babylonian Empire. They spend, give or take, about 70 years in a condition of exile, which means that there are people without a home. They have been extracted, uprooted from their home, and taken away. Now, there's two different kinds of empire philosophy, we'll say. The first kind is this, that when you invade a land, you take the people and you extract them from the land and you put them somewhere else. And then when you invade another land, you take the people from that land and you put them there. Why would you do that? To keep everybody unstable and off base. You feel uncomfortable. Remember, most people would have had a sense of national identity. It would be like taking you and uprooting you from here you are in comfortable middle-class America and dropping you down in Beirut. You're a little bit off-center. You're still trying to figure out how things work there. You no longer have a sense of national identity. You no longer have a sense of national pride. You are stripped of some of the things that give you identity. That's philosophy number one. Philosophy number two that the Persians are going to employ is, we invade people, but we take them back to their land, we give the land back to the people that it was given to, and we allow them a degree of autonomy, so long as they don't go too far. What's necessary for that type of empire building to work? Think about it. Degree of trust. I actually believe that if I appoint the right people, if I appoint you and I know something about your morals and values and I give you a little bit of freedom and I give you a little bit of ability to exercise your cultural distinctives, the way you worship, the way you live, the dress that you have, it keeps you happy. And in that way, I can control more area because independent countries are sort of like governing themselves within a grander whole. We can actually think of that in the early colonies kind of the same way. Does everybody understand? So either uproot people, shuffle the deck, keep everybody off center and confused. We could call that in the workplace, we would call that mushroom management. Is everybody familiar with mushroom management? Okay, some of you are, some of you aren't. Mushroom management goes like this, and I'm not going to use the real words. Mushroom management says that the best way to lead people is to keep them in the dark and feed them crap. Okay, crap is not the word that is normally used to describe mushroom management, but that's... Does everybody understand now, okay?
Could you use the right words, please?
It rhymes with chicken liver, okay? All right. So this is about to take place. The people are about to be returned to their home. Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem. In Judah, any one of his people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go to Jerusalem in Judah to build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem, and the people of any place where supervisors may now be living are to provide him with silver and gold and with goods and livestock and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. Okay, what are some of the telltale signs about Cyrus's motivation there? Oh, and if you're reading in a different translation, that is almost impossible to track. So you may as well... Okay. All right, here's what's going on. When you and I read the scriptures, and most of us, incidentally, if it weren't for the Bible, most of us would know nothing about Cyrus. Right? As a matter of fact, if it weren't for the Bible, most of us would know almost nothing about most of the people that are in the Bible, because the only reason we know about these people is because they're in the Bible. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Because that's true, and because of what the scriptures are about, we tend to interpret things without looking at the bigger picture. So here are the challenges to this story. It is first off theocentric, meaning it focuses on God. It's part of the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is this red thread that you have often heard talked about. It runs from Genesis through Revelation. It is the principle of redemption, and God is about the business of reconnecting with people, of restoring people. And no matter how many times, incidentally, talk about things that need to keep on being fixed. How many times has God had to reset the redemption plan? Just think about that. That red thread runs throughout the scriptures. This is one component of the red thread. And so when we read this and we read it without a knowledge of history, here's what we believe. That out of all the people in Cyrus's vast empire, he decrees that only the people of Israel are going to be returned, because Cyrus's whole mindset is, I just can't wait to build a temple in Jerusalem. But that's not really what's happening. What's really happening is Cyrus is doing exactly what we just described. He is sending peoples of all nationalities and creeds back to their homelands. And next week or next month, it was the people of some other country should be returned to their land to build a temple to their God. Now, why is this important in ancient thinking? Anybody? Because gods are considered regional. As a matter of fact, when you read some of the battles and the kings and the chronicles, you read that, well, this or that god is the god of the plains, or this or that god is the god of the mountains. In other words, it was a common assumption that gods inhabited an area and they were the god of that area. And if you wanted to do well in that area, you therefore appeased the god of that area. And so what Cyrus is saying is, I need this little slice of real estate and the people that are going to live there to live in harmony, and I need for that to work well, and I need for that god to bless my endeavors in that area, and therefore I am going to send the best of the best back there to build a temple to that god. Now, does that mean that just because that's Cyrus's mindset that God isn't using that? No. So God uses Cyrus's willingness to send the people back, but God has a second motivation for it. That also, incidentally, is a common theme in history. People do things for their reasons, and God ends up accomplishing what he needs to accomplish. Are we good? Questions? Did any of that make sense? Are you at all confused?
No, I will say this. The first thing I noticed was when it said the God of Israel. So that's what you're pointing out right there, right? So
yeah. And so, like I said, next week he would have been writing a decree to the God of something. And the week after, to the God of something else. Persia is an immense empire by this point in time. Now we turn over to chapter 2. Oh, and incidentally, when you read through the book of Ezra this week, I give you permission to bypass all of the genealogies. Okay? Someone who was married to someone or who had some relate, you can just skip over that. Or you won't read past chapter 2. I can promise you that. All right, now these are the people of the provinces who came up from the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had taken captive. So remember we said these people ended up in captivity due to the work of the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonian Empire is acquired or overrun by the Persian Empire. And so these people that went into captivity under the Babylonian rule are now coming out of captivity under the Persian rule. Got it? To return to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own town, in company with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, something or other, Bela, Mora, well, this is where we start all these names. Okay. What do they do? Yeah, I told you bypass that, didn't I? So where are they going? Each is going back to his own village within Judah. All right, now, just so that we put this into perspective, imagine that you were to put one of those little pinpoint things like Google does in downtown Philadelphia. The entire region that they are going back to settle would be from that pinpoint in the middle of Philadelphia, about 15 miles in every area, so a 15-mile radius out. That's the entirety of the land that they are going back to inhabit. And yet it features prominently in history. There's two types of people that are going back there. Remember, this is all about leadership, so you start to be drawing conclusions. There are priests and there are political leaders. Zerubbabel is the grandson of the last king of the southern kingdom. You tracking with me? So this is the royal dynasty's lineage. So how is that coffee in the back of the room? Is it pretty tasty? No, I was just curious on your behalf. So in addition to Zerubbabel, there are priests going back. So Cyrus is savvy enough to do this. He splits the power. I want a political leader to go back who has roots in Israel's past political dynasty, and I want a religious leader to go back. Each of them has their own field of specialty. They're going to complement each other, but they're going to be thinking about and focused on different things. Chapter 3. When the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled into their towns, I'm not going to take you to this right now, but you can make a note to yourself. The journey takes about 5 months. So I want you to think about that. They're walking for 5 months to get there. Later on, about 125 years, 130 years later, Ezra makes the trip, the guy who the book is named for. Ezra makes the trip, and it says that it took him about 5 months to make the trip. So if one small contingent takes 5 months to go, what would it be like if you were taking your family? So Dan, just think for yourself, what would it be like if you were to set out for St. Louis, hypothetically, and you were to go to yourself, and would there be any difference between you going yourself versus you taking your wife and kids?
Yeah.
Okay, can we all get an amen to that? There would be a definite difference. Okay, so if you were moving back to this area for the rest of your life, yeah, you'd probably have to take the wife and kiddies along. Okay, so it takes a while. And so notice what they do the first thing when they get back. This is why this is such a realistic chronicling. They settle into their towns. Why? Because before the men can actually do any work in Center City, if you will, they've got to get the family situated and safe and give them a way to live. Remember, these people don't have a lot of wealth that's theirs. They don't have a lot of means to survive, so they've got to go back to their ancestral homelands, lands that they themselves have probably never seen. So some grandfather of theirs somewhere during the captivity said, yeah, we own this slice of ground up here, 15 miles north of the city. It's toward that, it's near that stream and just a little bit from that tree over there. And they found their ancestral lands and they settled there. Then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to build the altar of God, of the God of Israel, to sacrifice burnt offerings on it. Now this is interesting. Huh? Thank you. Thank you. I won't need to take your word any longer for whether the coffee was tasty or not. Here's their first public works project. They're going to build an altar. Now, I want you to just think about this for a moment. If you were new in town, and remember, when they left, the walls were torn down. When we look later on in the book of Nehemiah, we're going to see that Nehemiah's public works project, which comes after this one, is to build the outer wall. Think for a moment. If you were new to town and you were not welcome in town, because it's not as if there a vacuum remained for that entire time. Well, they're gone for 70 years. It's not as if the people from the surrounding area say, you know, they'll probably be back someday. We probably shouldn't move into town. No, they moved in and set up camp there. So when these used-to-bes that want to be newbies come back to town, there's already other people there. What would you build first if you came to town? Would you build an altar or a temple or rebuild the wall of your city? Just meditate on that for a moment. Don't be too quick to say, well, I would build the altar because this is church and I want to give the right godly answer. Just ask yourself that question. Which would you build first? They chose to build that. Why do you suppose they did that? Oh, incidentally, this represents A. I know that doesn't look much like an altar, so we probably need to identify it.
They wanted God's blessing.
And why else?
Protection.
And?
Guidance.
Remember what Cyrus said? What's their mission? Yes, that's true. You're not wrong, and that's what the priest would have been thinking.
To pray to the God of that region.
Ah, Cyrus has an agenda too, right? And if they're going to be allowed to stay in the land, what do they need to do? They need to fulfill Cyrus's mandate. And Cyrus's first mandate, essentially, if you want to distill it down, is this. Y'all go back home and make the God of your land happy. Because if your God is happy, that slice of my empire will be happy. Okay? So we've got a politically motivated leader in the far-off hinterland, and we've got a group of people there. They have two different reasons that have conspired to accomplish the same thing. Make sense? All right. Let's move on. Okay, on the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord through the foundation, though the foundation of the Lord's temple had not yet been laid. Then they gave money to the masons and carpenters and gave food and drink and oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre so that they would bring cedar logs by sea from Lebanon to Joppa as authorized by Cyrus, king of Persia. So this is one of the cool things that they have. They have got letters of authority that give them permission to spend the king's money. Okay, because it's the king's money in addition to their private donations. Remember, they took donations from their own family before they left? But they're also getting a large slice of public works money from the empire to do this. So now they lay a foundation for a temple. Now, this is where time starts to matter. If you want to take a look at your notes, it's going to be on the bottom of the second, of the first side of your second page. So page 2, first side, and it says Kings of the Persian Empire. We're going to come back to that in a moment. I want you to have it handy. All right, so where are we? When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments and with trumpets, and the Levites and the sons of Asaph with cymbals, took their places to praise the Lord as prescribed by David, king of Israel. With praise and thanksgiving they sang to the Lord. He is good, his love endures forever. I want you to pay particular attention to the next couple of verses. And all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy. No one could distinguish the sounds of the shouts of joy from the sounds of weeping because the people made so much noise and the sound was heard far away. What's going on?
Some are mad and some are happy.
Well, they're not mad. They're mourning what they didn't do to preserve what existed already. Remember that I said that nothing that's good, that you call good in your life, is going to stay good forever unless someone fights to preserve it. These people are mourning because they know what was good and they lost, and now they're seeing something that has to be rebuilt.
These people being the ones that were already there.
These people are the ancestors of the ones that were there, and they had 70 years to meditate on what they lost.
And now these new people came.
And now the new people are here that have no knowledge and no recollection, and they're excited. Some people are mourning what they could have done and didn't do in the past. Other people are rejoicing about the future and what the promise of the future is, and their voices are all mingled together. And so within the same crowd, there are people with two different thoughts and reflections. I should have, I could have, I didn't. wow, this is great. I can't wait for what the future holds.
Parenting 101.
It has a lot of applications. But just remember, there are things that are good in your life and mine, and if we don't fight to protect them, if we don't fight to preserve them, we can watch them slip away.
All these people that they, when they went into Israel, they were people of God, though, right? The people that were there already.
The people, okay. So the people that are there already, that have settled while the other people are in exile, no, they are not people of God.
They're in Jerusalem.
They're in Jerusalem, but they're not. To them, to the people who have taken up residence, just think the word squatter.
Okay?
So the land is now filled with what we'll call squatters. Technically, they're not squatters because the people of Israel don't technically own the land anymore because they've been taken over.
So God's using these people, the outside people, to come back in and reestablish.
God is using His people who have gone off into exile. Imagine 100,000 people taken out of their homeland like refugees and plopped down 1,000 miles away. And they spend 70 years there. And now a small fraction of them are coming back and they're going to reoccupy this land and build it back up.
So pretty much a hostile takeover, I guess?
Here's why it's not entirely hostile in theory.
They were thrown out by these people that are in there.
No, they were not thrown out by the people that are in there.
They were taken.
Okay. So here's Babylon, right? The Babylonians, 100 years before that, come in and they clean house in Jerusalem and Judea. They take the whole land, they take the people, a lot of the people, take them into exile, and they are now going to be captive.
Is this where they took the best of the best people?
Hang on. Okay, meanwhile, while they're in Babylon, the Persians overrun the Babylonian Empire. So there is no Babylonian Empire anymore. It is now the Persian Empire. Think Canada comes south and invades the United States. Okay, the people are still in exile, though. They're still over here in their little bag. Okay, so Cyrus decrees and says, I want you all to go back there, some of you, and rebuild what was destroyed that was God's. Because I want this God over here in this land to be happy with me, and you're the people that know how to make that God happy. So you go back there and live in your little homeland and make your God happy because it'll go well for me. But meanwhile, this land over here doesn't stay empty. Other foreigners move into it. People from the surrounding area, it's like, hey, I got some new digs to move into. They all left town. This is great.
And there was some remaining Israelites that were still there too.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was taken.
That is true. There were some.
So you're saying, like, the belief is that this mourning, this shouts of joy, as well as tears and crying and weeping, for those who already have remained there the whole time, the other ones were in captivity in Babylon.
Yeah, but the ones what? Okay.
It has to do with regret for not following God. During that exile?
Here's the thing. Anybody that remained in the land, it doesn't matter what... So if you were a Jew, but you were somehow... You escaped the grand cleansing, you've probably remarried or intermarried, so you've mixed and mingled with the people of that area. This is what Samaritans were. Samaritans are in the northern kingdom, and remember how the Jews, if you look at the Gospels, how the Samaritans are a despised people group. Why are they a despised people group? Because they're half Jew and half something else. And because they're not pure Jew, even Jesus acknowledges, yeah, well, you Samaritans do this or that or the other thing. No Jew looked at a Samaritan and thought, part of us. It would have been sort of like someone who was racially mixed 80 years ago, 90 years ago in the South. You don't fit here, but you don't fit there. I really don't know where you fit. So why don't you just stay over here in your own little land? Now, when the Jews come back, okay, so to bring this back onto course, when the Jews that were in the Babylonian area are sent back, when they come back, they're not going to partner with the people that are already there. We're going to see that in a minute. Okay. When the enemies of Judah, we're in chapter 4 now. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord. You know how to move that from chapter to chapter, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Just don't forget my phone at the end of the day, okay? I don't want to be 11 o'clock and I'm wondering where my phone got to. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, when the enemies of Judah, I don't know what I said there, but they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because like you we seek your God." So there you see it, the first evidence that there are people in the land that are not part of the build, and they come to the people who are doing the build, and they actually go right to the head people and say, "Hey, we'd like to be part of this new thing that you're doing." But Zerubbabel, Yeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." Okay, so they were rebuffed. Now, we don't know what their motivations are, but we kind of have to be suspicious, even though the details are not there, that they're not all wholesome, healthy motivations. Okay, so think about this. Right, you're squatters in the land, but it's been good. It's been good for you. You've had a 70-year good run of life, and here come these outsiders, and they're coming back in, and they want to start rebuilding. But it's not just us versus them. Here's the problem: the guys from out of town have Cyrus on their side. You understand? They've got the decree, and they've got the resources, and they've got the king said so in their hip pocket, right? And these other guys, they don't have any of that. They're just sort of there because there was nowhere else for them to go. And so they catch an idea. Hey, we'll just be good neighbors, and we'll partner with these guys, and we can all build this together, and we'll be one big happy family. Here's the problem. Among all the other things that these people remember, they remember that whenever they intermarried, whenever they associated themselves with foreign kingdoms, whenever they associated themselves with foreign gods, nothing good in the long run ever happened. In other words, whenever they said, "Yeah, sure, we'll partner with this pagan king, we'll do this with these guys," nothing good ever happened. So these guys are saying to themselves, "No, this time we're going to get it right." So this is not them being unfriendly and uncivil, although it certainly would have felt that way to the people who volunteered to help. It is them trying to remain pure. And incidentally, look at what they use as a fallback. What's their fallback? "You have no part with us in building the temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." Okay, so they've got Cyrus in their pocket, and they pull out the Cyrus card, and they say, "Cyrus told us to build this, not you, and we want to be obedient to Cyrus."
The next two verses tell you a little bit more.
"And when the people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building, and they hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign," and this is where you got to go look at this timetable.
"Darius."
"And down to the reign of Darius." Okay, you see what's going on there? Cyrus the First, they set out, and it says at the beginning of what we read, in the first year of Cyrus, this is Cyrus the Second, who is also called Cyrus the Great, they set out in the first year of King Cyrus. How long do they have to resist the people in the land? Look at it. Throughout the entire reign of Darius. That is from 550 BC down to 486 BC. That's 64 years. Where were you 64 years ago? We already know where you were. Frankly, I wasn't even around 64 years ago. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is how long they are battling. They got this done quickly. 64 years later, and that still isn't done. That's demoralizing, isn't it? "At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem." Okay, so now we're down into line two of this timetable, if you're looking at the notes that you have. "And in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bishlam, whatever those names are, and the rest of the associates wrote a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic script, and in the Aramaic language. All right, and here's what the letter says, and we're going to go down to verse 12. The king should know that the Jews who came up to us from you... Now, in fact, they didn't come up from Artaxerxes. They were sent there by Cyrus. But came up to you, from you and have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid. Why? Think about this. What are they? Here's what the citizens are saying. We're good citizens, and we pay taxes and duties to the empire. The second you give those guys a solid foothold and allow them to build a walled city, they're going to rebel, and they're no longer going to pay their fair share of anything. You should know, King Artaxerxes, that this is a revolt that's taking place, and what you need to do first is check the history and see if these people don't have a history of revolt. Well, it turns out that they do. It turns out that they're not always loyal subjects when they're subjugated. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace and it is not proper for us to see the king dishonored, okay, do you think that's really their objective?
No, that's all
fluff. We are sending this message to inform the king, so that this search may be made in the archives of your predecessors. You see how long this is occurring? Remember what I asked, where were you 64 years ago? Could you remember what you had for breakfast 64 years ago? Do you see what I'm saying? This is so far removed from when this work began that they literally have to go through historical accounts to read and see if there was ever even a decree to allow the people to come back into the land. And this battle is still going on. Okay, so anyway, the king sent this reply. The letter you sent to us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order, and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolting against kings, and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of the Trans-Euphrates, and taxes, tribute, and duty were paid to them. Well, you see that? Not only aren't they going to pay taxes to the Persian Empire, but as a matter of fact, they become a competing taxation organization, and they're going to try to exact tribute. So they set up a competition here. Do you remember what we said? What principle of leadership that we've talked about this morning do you see at work here? Here it is. What you think needs to be fixed and you're working with all your heart and soul and strength to make right, somebody else says is the wrong solution and they're working the whole time to undermine what you're trying to do. One of the other principles that we need to absorb is that leadership is so difficult because not everybody agrees with what you want to do. And they're not going to remain neutral about what you want to do. And so for every good thing that you want to do in the workplace, there's somebody that's either jealous or resentful or thinks that it should be done another way. Why? Because we all have, despite what we would like to believe, we all have secondary, at least, selfish motivations. And so everybody is not going to be a fan and a champion of your leadership initiative. This is part of the reason why great leadership is so difficult and why things don't stay fixed for very long. All right. Where are we? As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shemaiah, the secretary, and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. Okay, so this was not just a friendly little entourage that says, we've heard the king say that you shouldn't. I think that by force, those couple of words really convey something powerful there. Then Haggai the prophet, we're now into chapter 5, and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judea and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel son of Shealtiel and Yeshua son of Jozadak set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. At that time, Tattenai, the governor of the Trans-Euphrates, and if you look there, it says Tattenai's letter to Darius. I don't know if you have that head. So we are now down to the third line here of the history. Are you following me?
You're also down 5 kings later?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
5 kings later, and this wall that they started, they laid the foundation for, that wall is still not done. Yeah. The time frame, 129 years. So where were you 130 years ago today? Incidentally, this morning, I'm reviewing my notes, so I'm ready for today, and I just Googled this. Grover Cleveland was president of the United States 130 years ago. Now, how many of you are intimately familiar with the practices and policies of one Grover Cleveland? I for one, don't really know a thing about Grover Cleveland, or what he did, or what he stood for, and I'm sure I've read somewhere at some point in time, but apparently it was very forgettable because I don't remember any of it. What is it like to have the staying power and the fortitude to pass your vision on? Now remember, this is 129 years ago. How many of the people that walked into Jerusalem 7 days after there, 7 months after they left Babylonia, how many of those people are alive 129 years later?
Not many.
Probably none.
Yeah, they had to recruit new help.
We can say safely that most of them were not alive any longer because there were adults in those families, right? Many of the people that left would have been in their 30s or perhaps their 40s or maybe even their 50s, and they were passionate about getting home to see this. And so one of the things about inspiring leadership is going to have to pass the vision for what can be done and should be done from generation to generation, because you might start a good work and never live to see it done. Now we know this, but we know it abstractly and in theory. The truth is that most of us get frustrated if we have a bad week and things don't go our way. What would happen if you had a bad century and it didn't go your way? You'd be prone to quit. I sure as heck know I would. At the end of a year of things not going bad, I'm starting to ask myself, do I really want to continue this? Oh, wow. Why didn't somebody tell me it was after 9 already? Look at that. Bill put his phone away already. Bill was thinking to himself, well, I had to get out of here 5 minutes ago. I've been waiting for you to shut up, but I've just been too polite. Take this timeline home and really reflect on it and read through the rest of the book. Okay? If you have any questions about it or you notice anything, remember, look at this through the lens of all the leadership principles that we've covered this morning, and we'll come back next week and we'll pick up where we left off.